Tom's Anna, more like just baked
but
in
it's
a pan.
All potato.
Yeah, I had to do it because I have a daughter named Anna, so I felt like she needed her own dish.
She did. Much easier than the hash brown thing, because hash browns are like roasties, they're darfain, they're hash browns, griddle cakes, they have so many names. Palm Anna is ubiquitous as just Palm Anna.
I feel like it is. I always feel like I'm like so, I'm very like, I feel like I always have to use the name correctly. I'm like, so it's not really authentic Palm Anna. I did a little Cacio e Pepe thing there that.
Oh, come that's on.
It was, it was 2017. It wasn't over yet.
Hey, it's not over yet at this time.
but actually the black pepper and the pecorino like sprinkled between each layer were so nice in there. And then you use the extra and you mix it with some arugula on top, and it makes this like nice natural dressing. It was so good. I'm like,
style.
That's basically what I'm trying to do is have fried potatoes for dinner, but by throwing salad on top, it's a balanced meal.
I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I visit someone you probably know as Smitten Kitchen from Instagram, or cookbooks, or the popular newsletter. Smitten Kitchen is not a staff of food minions, blogging and cooking and taking food pics, somebody barking out orders and figuring things out, following the latest trends. It's actually one person, and her name is Deb Barrelman, and she's delightful, and she's really hardworking and one of the OGs of real food blogging and testing the limits of what you know in food and trying new things. So give it a listen. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it. Write a review on your podcast app. That'll help other people find the show. If you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Tom Colicchio Heats Up Leftovers and last week's episode, Gail Simmons Has a Baby. Here's this week's conversation. Deb Perelman is smitten. I'm in a wonderful apartment in Manhattan, and I guess this is the, let me get my bearings, this is the Village. This is the
East Village.
This is the
but
East
yeah.
Village, yeah.
Yeah, but it's below 14th Street, so that makes it, I guess, the Village.
It is the Village, and it's a beautiful apartment with this amazing terrace, and my guest today is Deb Perelman, who is Smitten Kitchen. And runs an amazingly well-trafficked website that's beautifully designed and runs through recipes and reviews cookbooks and does all awesome, interesting work. And that website started way long ago in 2006. Is that
it
right?
It did. It's 12 years, that's which is crazy because I'm only 24. How precocious I must have been in middle school, right?
You did a really good job starting from nothing.
I know. I'm officially in that, like, does my blog make me look old age? But yeah, so no, I just started as a hobby and then I just kept doing it, and here we
That's
are.
That's what you have to do with blogs and things like this. But this is how Americans and people in North America learn about food now. And I think that blogs and, you know, and the following of cookbooks and the atomizing of one recipe and showing step by step why it works and the beauty of it really reframes how America cooks. But that's a big question. Is America cooking more?
Interesting to, yeah, I because I've heard that we're not, but I also feel like we're definitely in this age of curiosity about cooking. I'm not sure how much it's translating. I think it must be different in different places. I mean, I don't think that if you didn't live in a big city or in a suburb with like amazing stores with prepared food, you would even have a choice. So it's just it's really only like some parts of America even have this conversation.
Right.
And then I also think that even within those, there's so much good prepared food that you may not even, there's just almost very little need to.
Yeah, I mean, we're in New York, and I think you're a very packed kitchen with lots of foodstuffs.
It's always spilling over.
It's always spilling over. There are always going to be sirens. We're in the Village. but this, usually most New Yorkers use their ovens for fine lingerie storage and socks and extra pots that they will never pull out and use. And then they go out for takeout Chinese or order Seamless. So a working kitchen like this, is this difficult to navigate through the daily routine of cooking stuff every day in here? Do you get used to it? I mean, is there, okay, let's put it this way. I see the confines of your kitchen and it's probably 8 feet by 10 feet. Is there anything that you yearn for? Or is this
like,
enough?
I'd like more counter space, but I also have I'm sure this is like this particular thing where I'm always working on a lot of different recipes, and that's the ingredient spillover. I believe that with a little organization, I could fit just like what my family needs to eat
right
in the cabinets, in the fridge. But I'm always like, there's this overflow of pasta right now because I'm working on 3 new ziti recipes for articles. So it's like, there's always just something specific where I have more than a home kitchen would need. And that's where you end up with these spillovers.
Because you're at your office as well, yeah. Deb.
So I guess what would be nice is maybe just a pantry for like the extra stuff. But I always hate that. Like, I mean, definitely I could use more space. It's a little crazy that I work in a small kitchen. Like, nobody's making me stay in Manhattan in my small kitchen. I'm just kind of stubborn, and we're sort of waiting for the perfect apartment to fall into our laps. And when we do, I might not have a much bigger apartment, but I might not have a much bigger kitchen, but it'll hopefully have a little bit. Once I own it, I could probably build it out in a way that I could get it to work for me a little bit more.
But it works. I mean, I see the photography online, and I see the pictures of the recipes that you're embarking on, and you're writing these beautiful books. The first book is called The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook and came out in what year?
2012.
And then just in this past year, you've got Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites, which has a beautiful Pum Anna on the cover that's got pecorino and black pepper throughout it. Does it have egg in it? It's not that cacio pepe or anything like that.
No, it's not. Okay. No egg. I just like doing, I have fun playing around with vegetable dishes. I feel like most people know how to cook steak well, and if they really need to learn, they might go to a Cook's Illustrated or somebody who, like, you know, is a real expert on it, or their butcher. But I feel like not everybody knows how to turn like potatoes and arugula into dinner, or how to do something new with tomatoes.
I don't think you're alone in that thought. I mean, I share that on a professional level as a chef. I think chefdom has completely changed in the last 20 to 25 years because Americans, as chefs, finally figured out how to cook vegetables properly, how to use technique to advance something as simple as a roasted carrot to something I can sell because of necessity for a $14 roasted carrot with a sistahara and yogurt salad. But we had to because protein prices came up so much and there was a change in health attributes and what people really wanted. So it really changed the game, and we had to learn about how to cook Brussels sprouts so nobody would complain any longer about how horrid Brussels sprouts are. But we did, right?
I mean, Brussels sprouts were terrible when I was little. My mom used to get them in those bird's eye boxes frozen, and of course they smelled like swamps.
They're like sulfurous little orbs of mush.
But those fresh, I mean, they're like little baby crispy cabbages. You can roast them, they get nutty. There's so much more you could do with them.
But we learned texture, and we learned application of heat and got away from that. I always think that we learned to cook proteins from the French and the Italians, but we learned to cook vegetables from the British for some reason in the late 1940s. And it became an abomination of overcooked vegetables. Mm-hmm. And that was even what my grandmother fed us, too. Yeah. It was, you know, rutabagas for Christmas that were horrid. I mean, really bad. But, I mean, if you give me a rutabaga now, I can make it be a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm alone in that, in having those skills now. So it's really changed the game. But your books really latch on to vegetables a lot.
I mean, they're not, it's not vegetarian, but I was a vegetarian for a long time. And I fully eat meat now, but I still have that sort of orientation where I like seeing, like, meat to me is more of a side dish. Like, when I made these ziti's, I put a pot of meatballs on the side. I just kind of like letting
people adorn vegetables with the meat if they want to.
Exactly.
But it doesn't have to be the whole of the dish. It no longer has to be the center of the plate in the meat form. So these books, these are published by Knopf, which I have the most difficult time
doing.
How did the first book deal happen? Like, how did you put together a regular manuscript and submit it? Did somebody come and ask you?
It was more like somebody came and asked me. It wasn't Knopf specifically, but because I'd had my website for a bunch of years. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, if you start a blog, and probably not as much these days, but it blows up, you might write a book in the first year or two. But I was kind of like I don't know, it was resistant. Not that I didn't think cookbooks were great, but I just liked doing my website. This is great. I have total editorial control.
You're one of the OGs of food websites. Come on.
I just didn't quit. Like, everyone else saw the writing on the wall and they got out of there. And I'm like, no, I'm still having fun. I'll just do it, you know, as a hobby if it doesn't work out as a job. I really just enjoyed it. I'm not going to stop cooking and tinkering in the kitchen. I just may stop getting paid for it one day. So because I'd had my site since 2006, though, by the time 2009 rolled around, I'd definitely been approached by several like agents and editors before, but I hadn't really been interested. And then I kind of had a little shift in paradigm, thank God, where I got pregnant with my first kid, my son, and I just started thinking like, wait, maybe I do want something more permanent in this world. Something that you could pick up and hold, not like mommy once had a website. Like, I don't know. I finally kind of saw the beauty of cookbooks for the first, not cookbooks that I wasn't already in love with for the first time. And that's when I started working on my first one.
That's a good thing you fell in love with cookbooks, because we're in an apartment with about 8,000 cookbooks in it. So
I always loved cookbooks. I guess I didn't know why I needed a cookbook. I didn't get it. I think for most, and I've learned how stupid that is in hindsight, like that most food writers aspire to write a cookbook. That's like the hope and dream. And I was like, really?
Don't get it.
Love my website.
Your website was a cookbook in sense and purpose. I mean, people were going there and you were cooking through recipes and depicting pictures of them. And you do all your own photography?
Yeah, I do. I mean,
even in a book?
Yeah, I'm crazy. I just started doing it, and then it became the look of my site, and then I couldn't hire. Because I was like, so we're going to hire a photographer. They're like, No. Like, we want your pictures. And I'm like, but I shoot on auto. I don't know what I'm doing. So I also, to be fair, I hadn't heard anything good about cookbook publishing before I wrote my book. I mean, you didn't see a lot of books with, back then it wasn't standard that each recipe had a picture. You certainly didn't see process pictures. I just felt, and I had to have everything had 2-sentence head notes, and I liked talk. You had to write a food essay book or a cookbook. There was very little of both, and I wanted to do both. And so I had to, once somebody told me that I could write the book that I had in mind, then I was like, oh, a cookbook sounds fun. but it just, I didn't think that the paradigm existed out there, like of how you would do both. And we still struggled with it. We struggled with it with both books. Doing the layout where you have these long head notes without the recipes going onto 2 pages and upsetting people.
How do you write the head notes? Do you write them after you've written the recipe and tested it?
I don't know if you can tell, but I talk a lot. So
no, that's good. We like talking a lot.
It's kind of like that. I tend to write them. I have this thing where I think it's going to jinx it if I write the head note before I'm happy with the recipe, but I tend to write it like as I'm eating it, like in my head.
Okay, that's a good way of doing it. I have a bad habit of writing the recipes, testing them out, doing the photography, and then going back.
And
you're not in that place anymore, and you're sitting in front of 150 recipes that you all need to write head notes for, and they all want to come out like this. This is a good recipe. You should try it. I'm like hitting my head against a wall with writer's block.
3 sentences. No, I've totally done that. It always happens. I think I'm so organized. Obviously, you know I'm not organized, but I always think I'm so organized. And then I hand in the book and they're like, you're missing 10 head notes. And I have to go back and try to get into that space of where I was when I was passionate about that recipe. And they all come from the same voice. When if you just can jot down even 3 sentences, to jump where you want somebody to jump into that recipe. Think of like when you're gonna tell your friend about a thing you cooked last night, or your partner or whatever. Like you're gonna say like, I wrote, you know.
Yeah.
You're gonna say like, I made this thing last night. It had wild rice, but it also had this, and it was kind of interesting. And like that's
so good. And then we had it with this bottle of wine, and it was just the perfect thing because it was raining outside and it was just felt great, and we watched this. So you need to paint that picture. But they want to know that. People read cookbooks for a number of different reasons, but they really want to sit here in your kitchen in a lot of ways, not in a creepy way, but they just want to be involved with the...
Come on over. I'm for at least one more person.
So what's the most difficult part of writing a great recipe? And then... what is an absolutely fabulous recipe that you can remember that's not yours?
Oh,
so
wow.
What's the most difficult part of writing a recipe? To me, it's illustrating really clearly what my editor, who's Francis Lamb, was always looking for is, he's always editing with this note: I need a visual cue. I need a visual cue. And as to
what it looks like
when I'm sauteing this butternut squash, these cubes, I'm looking for this.
Them to get.
And, you know, we always default to golden brown. But what is golden brown when it's orange? So that visual cues are something that I stumble with a little bit. But then, you know, and then we always have to write for the fact that America often doesn't cook. So you say it needs 4 eggs, and then you, you know, obviously get a review that says, well, the eggshells were a little difficult to digest, but everything else was fine.
You want to put, see, I tend to want to put all the detail in, but you don't want the recipe to be 100 pages long, because then it no longer looks like a simple recipe. But trying to find that right level of detail, trying to anticipate the places where people will run into things. I've been pretty lucky about one thing, because my site's had comments from the beginning. One thing I always hear when it browned too much, my carrots burnt after 10 minutes, like all of those things. So I've gotten a little bit better at like anticipating the spots where people are going to start yelling at me.
But those are the sort of weird, unempirical things that we're encountering, because I don't know how powerful the stove is that they're working on. I don't know if it's the oven's been calibrated since 1974 and their 350 is actually 175.
Absolutely. And I don't know how they, like, oh my God, you know when a recipe has like 3 cups of spinach, you're like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Is it loose? Did we just drop the leaves?
Yeah.
Did you chiffonade them and pack them in tightly? Like almond meal is one of those. So that to me is the most stressful thing. It's either that or it's something that I really love, and it may sound a little bit weird, but I swear it's amazing. Those things don't tend to make it in, but I have like little recipes in my head or that I've made in some way that I have not figured out how I'm going to package it to convince anybody else to make it yet. This happens a lot, actually. Let me give you an example. My mother-in-law, my husband's family is Russian. They pickle everything. She pickles iceberg lettuce. It's amazing. It is so good.
I was lives the other day with a chef who does a saute of iceberg lettuce with soy paste and things like that.
Okay, my icebergs moment is coming. I saw like Helen Rosner wrote about it in the New Yorker a few months ago. I'm like, this is it. I've been holding this for like literally all 12 years I've had my site, trying to figure out how I'm going to talk people. And it is the most amazing thing on a BLT.
Okay, so go over what's the process?
Okay, so now I have to remember whether she does.
Does it have sugar in the pickle?
I think she does like she sits it out for a day.
Okay.
Like, you know, in the bucket, like she does, like, but it's like.
Like you're getting sauerkraut.
She has her formula, and I don't even want to say because I'm going to quote it wrong, but it's really like salt, salt, sugar, water, and that's it. And you sit it out for a day or two. I mean, it's a very light pickle. Yeah. It I always thought it was a fridge pickle with like vinegar, but she said she actually just salts it and leaves it out.
It's a lactic acid pickle.
I guess
just so. Like you do a full sour or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
But it's just like a day or so. And it just gets this
just
crisp
iceberg
to
lettuce.
It. It's
Does
still
she take
crisp.
The core out?
She takes the core out and she uses the leaves. And they still have some crisp to them. And then she usually puts dill and garlic in because, you know,
Russians.
Russia. Yeah, you got to have dill and garlic. They also put dill and garlic in the pickled watermelon. So it's all relative. But it's so good on a sandwich.
That would be good with the watermelon.
Or I feel like, you know, pickled, like, it needs to be some sort of, like, I don't know, fresh stuffed cabbage type thing where you put it in the pickle. Like, I feel like there are some things that I would just, you just hold on to them forever and you try to figure out how you're going to talk people
like
into
wrapping
them.
It around like a little kibbeh or something like that.
Yeah.
As a little hors d'oeuvre or something like that. Yeah,
all right. Well, you're going to come up with a way to do it. And
okay.
You're gonna tell
me how to do it. We can team up whenever you want.
We're going to figure it out. So there's sometimes it's just stuff that I love. Like, I love celery. I love walnuts. People are like, those are very hard stuff.
I love celery. Celery is so inexpensive. And so wonderful.
It's so good. Those celery, almond, parmesan, like crunchy salads with like that. Sometimes they have anchovies in them, but they don't even need it. Like, they're so good.
Yep. And celery to me, like, you go and I love cardoons, but cardoons are hard to find when they're really good. And they're
especially
can be really
North.
Expensive.
I don't even see them, really.
You don't see them. But I mean, you can mimic a cardoon by taking a really fresh head of celery and quartering it lengthwise and then roasting it aggressively and then serving it with like grated egg on top and a bit of olives and and a good amount of black pepper and a drizzle of olive oil and a squeeze of lemon. It is so good. It's like revelatory, simple roasted vegetable that costs at every grocery store like 99 cents a bunch.
Well, until you start writing recipes for it.
Yeah.
Drive up the cardoon rents.
Yes, exactly.
But no, I think it's maybe, you know, people always remember eating like they remember it being stringy or getting stuck in their teeth. But I'm talking about slicing it.
Yeah, against the grain.
Yeah, there was no, I have.
Or you can peel it.
I don't think
it.
It's an either book, but it's on my site where I have this egg salad with like lightly pickled celery in it. And that you just soak it in a little vinegar, salt, sugar mixture.
But egg salad needs, egg salad and chicken salad. If they don't have celery, to me, they are not real.
Yeah.
They need celery.
My husband's always like, why are you putting celery in this?
No, that crunch is ubiquitous with it. It is so important in that dish. I need those
little, yeah. And a little, like, lightly pickled just wakes the whole thing up.
And then sautéed really thinly sliced celery with salmon is great with a lot of dill and lemon zest and things like that. So, yeah, celery is like the unheralded staple of the foundational vegetables.
All right. So team celery, team pickled iceberg. What other?
I'm totally into
fennel,
the pickled iceberg.
Fennel is such a hard sell.
I love fennel.
Which I think this one, I did think a bunch of people told me this is the first time they liked fennel. It was just thinly shaved, again, with an arugula salad, like a mustard vinaigrette, which I think, you know, that's with lemon and olive oil and mustard. Fennel is so good.
It is so good. Yeah, I make a fennel slaw, but I have been for years of just shaving fennel against the grain and then tossing it with lemon juice and a little bit of vinegar and olive oil and salt and then letting it sit. And then you hit it with a little ton of fresh mint at the very end. And because
so
it just macerates on the counter and loosens up the structure of it as it macerates, it's just delectably good and just has a high amount of acidity. So what are Americans, what comments are you getting? What's really beloved these days of the recipes you do at smittenkitchen.com? And why? And how has that changed in the last, you know, number of years? What are American palates going to?
I definitely think, you know, I mean, you have a lot of people who realize that they have gluten allergies. But beyond that, I feel like a lot of people are just trying to move away from bready-based meals. They want bread as an accent, but not as the center. And because of that, I think there's a lot more, just a general interest in a vegetable or meat-focused dish that, you know, the bread. And I love bread, but I'd rather eat it when it's good and worth it,
right,
and not just fill up on it. Something I did in this book was called, I call it pizza beans, but that's because I have little kids and I have to sell them on it. But it's basically like a baked ziti, but you use large white beans, mm-hmm, and you cook it in the tomato sauce. We use some sautéed vegetables, and then you cover it with cheese and you broil it like a baked ziti. Like
you're making a casserole.
You're making a casserole.
A bean
okay,
casserole.
We put some garlic bread on the side because we still have to get the kids to the table. But it was like just that idea of like it's usually done with pasta or something heavy, and the beans.
Could you
have
do
this,
it with canned beans?
You can. I will say that, you know, if you
they're
can get
break
those
down more.
Yeah.
I mean, you're really talking about Corona Gigante.
I'm talking Gigante's, and that's actually was my inspiration was like Greece 20 years ago, going there and having like the big white beans cooked in tomato sauce. There it's done with dill and often served with meat, but I just wanted to do like a Italian American version.
That's totally cool.
So that was something that I didn't expect to be able to sell people on, but it was fun. I think it's a fun way to use beans where you might have used something heavier.
So Americans are requesting more beans, less bread, more vegetables.
More vegetables.
I think they're really, their palates want bigger and bolder flavors because of just global aspects of food that we're seeing. So a lot more umami.
Mm-hmm.
I think pickling's pretty big for palates.
A lot
right
more.
Now.
It's getting a lot easier to.
But soy-based stuff, kimchi-based stuff, mm-hmm, things that really have a big pepper kick are really big. Not just for the heat, but for that really getting your palate working type of sensation. I don't think continental flavors and the blandness of, you know, 1970s continental food is the thing anymore at all, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
We like that because we like big flavors. I think we're getting away from butter and cream a little bit, which is fine. I think that there's a hipness to a lot of European food and Eastern European food and going into Middle Eastern food based on the popularity of like Otto Lange's books and things like that.
I think the butter and cream thing is always, I definitely think we're getting away from it, but then I also think that we're getting away from the low, we've definitely gotten away from the low fat thing. Vegan is really big, actually.
Yeah, I guess it is.
I know. It's so, my sister
is vegan
now. I mean, I don't know how long. I mean, maybe forever, but we'll see. But I think
she's not just going through a phase.
I don't know. I can't say that. That's rude.
Do you want me to call her?
Yeah, I think it's okay. Phase.
Yeah.
She's going to kill me if she hears this. So anyway, let's just say not my sister, but no, I know, or people, like, they go through a phase where they just want to take a break from all the clutter in their diet as they see it. So yes, I think that's, who buys margarine, I think.
But somebody buys margarine.
Yeah. What, there's a brand of, vegan butter, Earth. Is it Earth Balance?
Earth. Yeah, I think it is.
Earth Balance.
Yeah. One of those brands.
I forgive me. After like years with babies, I'm like, I always mix it up with Earth's Best, which is a kid brand of like wipes and stuff. I'm sorry.
No, no, that's fine.
It's just I've many times said the wrong word there.
That's.
I think it's Earth Balance. Is a very popular, and I know a lot of my readers. They take the cookie recipes and the cake recipes
and they use that
and the frosting, and they say it has a really great flavor. None of that oily heaviness that we associate with margarine.
No, I think the recipes are much more adaptable than ever to. Can be made gluten-free, can be made lactose-free, and dairy-free, and so it, because of products that are on the market. I tend not to use a lot of that stuff. You know, I'm a restaurant chef, so I slip in 2 pounds of butter in every portion of mashed potatoes.
And everyone's like, why do my mashed potatoes not taste as good?
I'm always like, wow, these like, are really good.
It's the butter.
And I'm like, yeah, you're about to die. But no, they enjoy it.
Yeah, they do. They enjoy
it, and that's the important thing. I'm going to cycle back because I'm erratic. What's a amazing recipe that sticks out in your mind over the years that you've just always thought was just a perfectly written recipe? Anything come to mind? Mine is Paul Bertoli. He was one of the chefs at Chez Panisse in the early days, who later did Olivetto in Oakland. And he wrote a lot of the recipes, and I think the second Chez Panisse book. And his recipe for risotto was like 3 pages long. It kind of just had this beautiful, brilliant ending about just being, yeah, you know when it's done, eh? You know, it's... But at that point in time in the recipe, you did know when it was done. It was illustrative to define what you were looking for. And the time at that point wasn't really necessary, that you understood what the end result was. And that, to me... sort of define something as irascible and difficult to pin down in timing as risotto was very clear.
I find risotto... Okay, so I definitely know you from Top Chef, right? I've seen you on TV many times as a...
I don't claim anything about that, but yes.
Okay. All I'm saying is that this risotto works in. Every time we used to see somebody making risotto on the show, we're like, don't do it. The risotto.
Don't do grits. Don't do risotto.
Don't do risotto. Don't do grits. Stick to scallops. Everybody likes scallops on the show. I can't imagine how many scallops you had to eat over the years. Separate conversation. But risotto is so tricky. I don't like making risotto for friends because... there's this one point where the rice is not overcooked and it still spills out on the plate, which
is something
I remember Tom Colicchio once saying.
Right.
And that moment is about 2 minutes wide.
And then it goes away.
And then after that, it's gone and the rice is soft. How could you ever serve that?
And then it all crimps up into a lump. Hence, you get this pile of risotto standing like a mini mound on a plate.
Or it looks like oatmeal in a bowl.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
and it's
just
wrong.
And it's glue. It's so
and it's glue.
And the cheese, all of that cheese and the butter, they start to thicken.
But that's the key, is you need to work that butter in like you're emulsifying with the butter and really work your wooden spoon to whip it in at the very end and to give it loft.
I'm going to look up that recipe because I have that book, and also because I would never make risotto for somebody.
It's a good recipe. It really is. It clarified a lot at a young age. I mean, I'm trying to think of professionally the books that really kind of had a lot of influence on the food I was doing. And I'm predominantly a French kitchen, so it was odd that I was kind of branching out. But this is when I was really young, like 18. And going and buying the Rogers and Gray, the first River Cafe cookbook. Mm-hmm. And it could be called the River Cafe cookbook in Canada, but it had to be called the Rogers and Gray book here because there was a River Cafe in Brooklyn and still is. Mm-hmm. And that was seminal for its simplicity in looking at concrete and core ideas of Italian food presented in just the freshest manner possible. And it was really unadulterated food. It was just so purist. That was wonderful. And then the Chapinese books were another just revelatory look at how you take something so simple as wonderful food and just treat it with care and precision and arrive at results that are great. The cassoulet recipe in one of the Chapinese books is another one that's just so long and contrived and crazy, but it made me do it and made me do this really exciting thing where at 18 or 19, you're like, wow, this is a clarion call. So amazing. That's what cookbooks can do, and that's what they should do. But it's so hard to get beyond that writer's block sometimes and make it that way.
They probably wrote while they were eating it.
They probably wrote while they were eating it.
I often have my laptop right in there, and I'm working, and I'm taking notes in my laptop, like in the document with the...
Do you find the people who are Smitten Kitchen regulars online, are they cooking with their laptops or iPads in the kitchen?
I think iPads. I think it's very common. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
I'm always terrified to cook with a computer in the kitchen.
I'm living on the edge, especially because it's right next to the faucet and I have kids and we have a sprayer on the faucet. As soon as they come home, I get super stressed because we all know how this story is going to end. Deb was 3/4 done with her third book and then the hose hit. Exactly. I do try to save everything on Dropbox and not locally, but still we all know how it's like. It's like when you're, I don't know, whenever you're, like, you're putting something near the sink, that anything, you just know it's going to fall. And you know how you're going to lose your phone one day, right? Like, you know it, but you still do it. You just have to wait till that day happens and then
The phone's going to fall in the toilet one day. These things are inevitable.
I mean, I was thinking, I was like, the sink, but you know what I meant.
Yep.
So, the opposite of the toilet, the Zuni Cafe roast chicken.
Oh.
But who was, I mean, I'm sure somebody was, but this idea that she always just salted her birds for a couple days before and it made the skin so crisp and the meat was so juicy.
And you cooked that recipe.
I cooked that recipe.
I still cook it like every week. It is a seminal, amazing
recipe. And I want to say
I don't do all the steps of the bread salad and everything like that, but it is the core way of roasting a chicken. So it's salted heavily inside and out about a day beforehand, placed on a plate and stuck in a fridge uncovered. And then you take it out and you blot away all the juices and you get it in a high heat oven for generally just over an hour.
You start it breast side down, I want to say.
And then you can invert it.
I literally make this every 2 years and I'm still like, I don't remember it. So I am obsessed with like kind of just reworking recipes and trying to make them a little more human and a little less chefy, just so more people won't make them. And, you know, nothing measured in teaspoons, no savory ingredient measured in teaspoons. And I have tried so many times to kind of streamline that recipe. And you can't.
You can't.
You have to keep it the way it is. And so I'm thinking of these multi-page recipes. And that's one that there's just no reason to. There's no benefit.
And Judy Rogers was just ahead of her time in so many ways. That restaurant was just amazing back in the day when she was with us. But, you know, her head captains and the staff bought that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still doing that chicken. And it is still amazing.
Still really
good. And that restaurant wedged into that little triangular corner, eating that and drinking fine Burgundy is something that everybody in America.
All right, I gotta go. I can't be in New York anymore. I gotta go.
I mean, Zuni, which is on Market Street in San Francisco, to me is, it's the Gramercy Tavern of San Francisco.
Very much.
It is such an iconic restaurant and so important to that has driven everything else around it and its community. But that chicken, oh, man.
I'm like, but what's the Gramercy Tavern iconic dish?
That's a good question.
Because I feel like it's had a few waves of...
It has. And Michael Anthony's been in charge for a very long time
and
now.
And he's got a couple dishes that he's really like, but I can't think of
his
any...
His handle with fish is...
I feel like if Danny Meyer's listening, it's like, don't you know about that? Well, we're missing something, but I...
Yeah, but also to a point about Danny Meyer, with it being unquestionably an iconic American restaurant and to me the iconic restaurant in New York... It is Danny Meyer. That's the important dish in Gramercy Tavern, is that he has touched that whole place with such an authentic zeal of hospitality that it just breathes happiness and joy when you walk in.
when they started doing that vegetable tasting menu, I mean, it's got to be like 15 years now, maybe longer. Mm-hmm. That changed my life. I was actually still vegetarian back then, but even when I started eating meat, I still loved going there
for like, that.
Show me 15 cool things that you can do with vegetables. I'm so much more inspired. Again, when I want a steak, I'm going to get a really good, perfectly cooked steak somewhere. But if I want vegetables, inspire me, please.
But that's the thing, is that chefs and Smitten Kitchen and other websites have really changed the way we cook vegetables. So, yeah. And I think it's finally permeated in the households and really made a difference. So in the way we eat every day, you know, I can't think of America enjoying kale or Brussels sprouts or broccoli at home that much years ago.
No.
But now they can be made into wonderful things in a couple of simple technical steps that everybody can understand. And I have no idea why that we kept that from America for so long.
I feel like a lot of what we're doing with like kale and Brussels sprouts and broccoli, though, are things that we've always known have worked for food. We just hadn't applied them to vegetables yet. I mean, what are we looking, you know, Parmesan, you know, but trying to turn it into salad. Or here, these are shortcakes, which I'm sure you're extremely familiar with in the South. But I just did a tomato salad and whipped goat cheese and then a scallion biscuit. So now you have a summer
and
tomato.
And this is on the cover of this
is the, I'm sorry.
Cookbook, and it looks like strawberry shortcake in a savory style with tomatoes. And it looks beautiful. And that, but that is turning food on its head. And I think that that's why we've gotten better at figuring out how to apply skill sets to food and really broaden the scope of good food. I think that vegetables became much more a focus, and I think I touched on this earlier, in restaurants because of higher accelerating costs of proteins and changing in health and what people wanted, different diets coming around and fads and things like that that chefs had to address. So we were kind of pinned up against a wall to make sure that we could cover all those bases. Mm-hmm. So we had to learn how to cook carrots again.
But when people have carrots that are, I mean, I'm sure you've had the Nomad carrot tartare.
Right.
That is like everyone's favorite dish. It's one. That's got to be a. That has to be one of the best things that's ever happened to carrots.
The Nomad crudité is phenomenal with the radishes and the butter.
Oh, I know. I mean, well, because it's butter.
Daniel Hume.
I know. Is there anything he can do? What did? Oh, that snow pea, like cacio e pepe.
Oh
thing,
yeah.
That one with the pecorino. That salad. And somebody who used to work in the kitchen was saying, I mean, there's literally a person just doing the snow peas all day. Like, that's how many they need and how carefully they need to be prepared, which is amazing to me. We're just like, your editor may not agree, but I think you're very good at giving context. Because I keep mentioning random dishes and then you talk to tell people where they can find them.
That's good. Let's talk about social media and what it impacts in your world and how it impacts mine. For me, it's not exactly, I'm not so maybe astute or smart as a human to realize that maybe I've created a brand. You definitely have. My brand is more, what I do on social media is the restaurants have their own things, right?
So you can be yourself.
So I can be myself.
Just share your interests.
Complete jackass, rabble rouser.
Now, I was actually looking at your Instagram before, and I actually thought it was refreshingly real. Nobody's holding. Real. I did not get the impression that anyone else is holding the phone for you, captioning and tagging brands on your T-shirt or something like that.
No.
So there's something really genuine and real, and I'm sure people relate to that, and you probably get a lot of comments on what seemingly simple things because people feel like they're really talking to you because they are.
They are, yeah. But it's led me to, peel back on maybe the amount of time I spend on it. To me, I Twitter is my political universe and I can spend all day, Tom Kleeke is another guy who does too, spend all day, rabble-rousing politically about things in this crazy changing world. But Instagram is kind of my visual perspective on the world. And so it contains a lot of doodles and stuff like that. It probably doesn't do much for my brand. But you have a gazillion followers on Instagram.
But I also, I do the dual streams too. So I have this Smitten Kitchen, though it's just me and I am the brand, the brand is me. I have a Smitten Kitchen stream and that probably has the larger numbers by a bit. And then I just have a personal one, which is just because I felt like if my site is about food, let me just stick to food, stick to cooking, stick to things that relate to
lane.
I stay in my lane on Smitten Kitchen. And then, but if I'm traveling or something, like we were in Washington, D.C. this weekend and I want to share little bits and pieces and places that we, this doesn't relate to Smitten Kitchen as a site or cookbook at all, so I just put it on my own personal one, which also has some following but not nearly as much.
I think it's important to have that demarcation because I'm not sure if Smitten Kitchen is the place to show pictures from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, but it's totally cool. Should
I make no promises to be interesting in my personal life,
right? No
I mean,
I
even
make
that
no
it's filtered either. I'm not like, you know, I'm not sharing like what my kids are doing every day because that's their lives too,
right?
But it's because it's a public stream, but so it's the similar thing, but it's still, it's maybe not as off the cuff as yours, and maybe I should work on
your
that.
Kids are 9 and 3.
9 and 3,
yeah. Does the 9-year-old have a cell phone?
No, don't even tell him that that's an option. No, not he wants one so badly. I was like, why don't we work on you getting ready for school on time?
Yeah.
I'm being polite here. I'm like, why don't we worry
about
you?
Well, then, see, my argument would be like, well, maybe I need an alarm clock on a cell phone.
I feel like there's going to be a point, especially as a city kid, because he's kind of at the age where we're almost at the point, and I'm glad he's not here to hear this, where he could probably be going places and running errands on his own, but I'd want him to have a cell phone before he did that because I wouldn't be able to track him.
And people question that. But I mean, I was walking to school in a city when I was like 6, 7 by myself.
Where did you grow up in?
I grew up in Ottawa, Canada, but then spent a lot of time in the American South.
Canadians are so nice.
Oh, they are so nice. Non-judgmental, very kind.
So the anti-New York.
kind of the anti-New York. But I mean, I'm walking over here today. I saw tons of kids who were, you know, probably grade 5, grade 6, just cavorting together on their way home from school. And it was mellow. It seemed totally safe.
I think a high concentration of people actually makes people nicer.
I think so.
I just think you don't talk to strangers. That's all. Like when I'm book touring or I'm walking around in another city and somebody says hi to me, I'm like, well, and I hate
buddy.
That. I'm like, that's a little weird. And I'm like, no, Deb, that's what, but I'm just, it's not my fault.
That's what humans do in other
No,
places.
In New York, if someone's like, hey, how are you doing? You're like, oh, get
hey,
away
crazy
from
person. No, thanks.
Hold your kids. No, you try not to, but you try to just roll with it, but it doesn't mean the same thing in New York, unfortunately, but that's what a high concentration of people do. So he doesn't have a cell phone. He would definitely like one. He's probably old enough to walk places on his own, but I don't know, is what's unsafe about him walking places on his own the world, or is it the fact that most kids don't go places on their own at his age, and so therefore he sticks out?
I think kids in New York do, though. I think kids are raised differently in the inner city.
I'll see. I think a lot's going to change in the next couple of years for him when he's going to be in middle school, and I'm not
going to be able to. Yeah, it changed. My two girls are 14 and 16 now, and it's crazy how they change. Back to social media. I mean, it is a necessity for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets new recipes out there in hands and drives traffic to the site. You know. But what new things can people show, or what do people really want on social media? Like, what do they want on the Smitten Kitchen Instagram?
Oh, my goodness. Video.
What's huge?
Pivot to video. Everybody wants you to. Video. But I think that I always just think of it as a way to reach people. And it's like, if people want to meet you on Facebook, I'll be on Facebook. If people want to meet you on Twitter, I don't think what I do is what I do on the website and what I do in the cookbooks. Like, that's writing recipes and talking about it, where I got there. Everything else is just hopefully just leading people back. So I would think that what you do is what you do in your cookbooks and what you do in your restaurants and any shows you're working on. Everything else is just a way to broadcast it and tell people that. I also like that you can have more casual conversations and, like, you know, with Twitter, or you can have a more focused interest, or you can share things from other sites that may not make sense on your own, you know, streams. But I think it's a necessity, but I don't think you have to make it your whole life. I think that I don't think people are like, oh my God, there's no new post from this person today. I'm so upset. I'm unfollowing their site, or I'm never going to the restaurant because they haven't posted in 2 weeks.
Look, well, you can change your last name to Kardashian if you want, but yeah, those are the only people in this world that people want that continuity of content from, I think. But
what I'm saying is, I think people only notice when you show up. They don't notice when you've gone.
When you're not there.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're not posting every day, I always think there's this idea that you need to have content, 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 and I don't think it's true. I think you need to have good content when you show up.
So I'm looking at one of the cookbooks in your and from your vast amounts of cookbooks and piles that are strategically located on the floor and on bookshelves.
Okay.
In a variety of ordering systems.
I think that notice from the publicist.
I do love the fact that this publisher. this one has a sticky note.
I see why, because it's from Knopf, so they sent it over.
A fun one with a smiley face. And it is a fun one because it's the new Joe Beef cookbook from the Montreal restaurant group called Surviving the Apocalypse, another cookbook of sorts. And that's David McMillan and Fred Morin, who are dear friends of mine and wonderful, wonderful humans. And this is a...
So you've definitely gone up there and had the experience.
I've lived only in Montreal for a long time. But okay. We actually, back in, it would have been 1991, I was cooking at a restaurant called Buena Notte on Saint-Laurent in the Plateau in Montreal. And they were cooking across the street at a place called The Globe.
Wow, really?
Both of them together. So, yeah, we have this crazy, weird history of bumping into each other. But, yeah, I go up to Montreal a lot. And I think Montreal is, outside of New York, my favorite dining city in North America these days. It's just phenomenal.
It's really fun. French is going strong up there.
French is going strong up there. But
not
I mean,
just in the language, but yeah, they're really innovating it.
They really are. And they're using a lot of Canadian product. They're really giving an identity to Canadian food, which has been long a head scratch around what is Canadian food, and everybody's like, well, it's poutine and tortiere and maple syrup.
But Canada is this it's really massive huge country. Vancouver and is like a different continent from Montreal, and I think people
totally
don't
agree.
Really understand that.
And so is Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and PEI. Yeah, but the big
they
thing.
They have their own culture and their own flavors and their own agriculture.
So what we identify as Canadian food is typically really more regionalized Quebecois food, the food of Quebec, of the province of Quebec. Because then if you go to, around Newfoundland and Fogo Island, which is one of the most beautiful places on earth, it's all built around cod and snow crab and preserves and pickles and potatoes, because that's what's in Newfoundland. But Quebecois food is interesting, and these guys have just, they always push the limits. This is their second cookbook, and it's just beautifully written. It's great, really good photographs, but it's fun. They're fun.
They're fun. They're really having fun. They're not concerned with... We're looking at this page, which is Microwave Foie Gras with Fred Morin. Did I say his last name correctly?
Yep.
I mean, I've met him, Frederick but I just... and he's got this... I don't know. Is this a modern microwave or is this a
microwave
from the 70s?
And he's about to cook foie gras in it. And it's kind of this... The layout of it makes it look like...
Serves 8 to 10. And so he's teaching us. I mean, I love it. That is so modern and fun.
But
there's a sense of humor to it. A little bit like the Brooks Heedley. Am I saying it right?
Superiority Burger.
God,
Brooks used to be the
right in this neighborhood.
Chef. Yeah, he's a punk rock guy who is a musician and a pastry chef, and he was the pastry chef at Del Posto for years. And
he's a fantastic. Superiority Burger, right?
Yeah.
A few blocks from here.
Which is
a
vegan restaurant that's phenomenally interesting.
Is it vegan?
I know it's vegetarian.
Maybe
it's not vegan.
I should know. I go there a lot. Yeah. I feel like it's not vegan.
I still feel
but
healthy
it's so,
when I leave.
Yeah, I know. I'm very earnest. I eat fried vegetables, so it must be a salad.
No, they do. Yeah.
In style, though, the cookbook offbeat doing their own thing style, I very much relate to both of them.
Well, it's honest and authentic, and the purity of being sort of punk rock people like all these people are is kind of taking a different look at a commonly done system of food and relaying recipes and turning its head a little bit and having it fun, having it be fun. But that's what the Joe Beef restaurants are. They're just fun.
This looks so good. This looks so good. Look how happy they are. They're having fun.
And this is the Anglais Sous-Marin Special AA.
See, I would recognize a hanger steak anywhere. That's my favorite. I saw that and I'm like, that's a
hanger steak. Why is hanger steak good to you?
I don't know. I feel like because I can't mess it up. I'm not, I can mess it up, but I mess it up a lot less often. Remember, I'm not working on good you know, I don't have great kitchen equipment here. I have a pretty dinky stove.
The Spinton kitchen is not state of the art, but
no, rental kitchen where they were like, we could have spent less. we could have spent more on your oven, but we didn't want to. And I know I could like go buy a new one and replace it, but I'm very stubborn. And I'm like, if this oven works for other people, I'll make it work for me. We have a teeny tiny grill outside that's completely illegal. So I didn't mention that. You're not supposed to have
them. Not in New York.
In New York. Well, you're not supposed to have them within 10 feet of a building, which is difficult if your terrace isn't more than 10 feet wide. But I find it, I just don't mess it up as much. I feel like I can do a pretty good job of keeping it black on the outside. I like a little char and still very pink on the inside.
Yeah. I mean, I love hanger steak, which is always called like one of the butcher cuts that people used to take home as butchers because nobody really knew about it. And it was a smaller muscle structure. And it's kind of, it's like a oddly shaped small tenderloin. And it's got one striating piece of sinew in between that you have to get out. But other than that, it's got a flavor that's almost offally. Mm-hmm. It's got a little trace of sort of liveriness and kidney overtones, but that's totally palatable, only makes it a little more exciting. It just has a base minerality to it.
I love
that's
it really good. With like bright things on top. I started eating it at Barbuto in the West Village. I love the way, I know Jonathan Waxman is so famous for his chicken, but I always get the hanger steak there, and he usually has some roasted vegetables that are also a little bit marinated, that will be like roasted leeks that he's tossed into a vinaigrette, whatever he's got seasonal and going on that day, and then he'll kind of top it with that, and it's always, or he'll do it with one of his salsa verdes, and it's just, it has such a freshness to
Waxman's got a good grasp of sort of that Provençal sort of use of vinaigrettes and vegetables. That's so good.
I feel like he almost never, I mean, I know he uses butter sometimes, but I feel like he never uses cream. Yeah. He'll put a little butter in that gnocchi and a couple of the pastas, but he's
that's
really
not
like,
a little bit of butter
like,
in that gnocchi.
I think I know I've watched you make. But he's like, yeah, we're just going to put a tablespoon in.
Yeah. Thunk.
And that's probably just the one he makes for the camera. But for the most part, though, it's not creamy. There are no creamy sauces there. Everything there is like punchy and bright.
Yeah, Barbuto is one of those restaurants. I love restaurants, and I love going to restaurants. I love eating out. And there are very few restaurants that are, to me, food that appeals to me virtually every day of my life. And a Barbuto is one of them.
That's exactly what we say. That's probably the restaurant I go to the most in New York. And the reason is that I feel like it's a weekday night place. You're not going to walk out of there feeling like, oh my God, what did I eat? Yeah. I got to go to the gym twice tomorrow. Like, it's not that kind of meal. I feel like everything has a kind of fresh brightness to it that it just doesn't feel heavy. The portions aren't crazy. There's no bread on the table that's going to distract you from your meal. The kale salad is so famous.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good.
Russ and Daughters is another restaurant that I could pretty much eat at every day.
Really? I need a nap after that. I love
napping. I'm 47 nowadays. I really adore napping.
When do you have time to nap?
I don't, unfortunately. So I don't.
Russ and Daughters. I'm sure you've been to Via Carrata too.
Via Carrata and Buvette are both favorites. They're just wonderful. And her sense of design is so good. And these are all, you know, you guys should be writing this down, but we'll put it up on on Instagram too, of these lists of places that we're talking about, because there's so many to really look out for in New York if you're traveling through. Deb Perelman, it has been a delight to be in Smitten Kitchen tonight with you, hanging out and talking about food and cookbooks and the things we do. And it's been a great discussion. Thanks a lot.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming over.
This episode of Hugh Atchison's Stirs the Pot was taped by Brian Blum on location in Manhattan in Deb Perelman's little apartment. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mazzill edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison's Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and come back on Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram @HughAtchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Be swell.